Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Joe Connison, whose latest book is It Can Happen Here, Authoritarian Peril in the Age of Bush. Earlier books are The Raw Deal, about Bush, Social Security, and the dismantling of the New Deal, Big Lies, which discusses the right-wing propaganda machine, and The Hunting of the President, co-author, which talked about the giant conspiracy against the Clintons during the Clinton years. He's a columnist for both New York Observer and Salon.com and has been a regular guest on Air America. Joe Connison, several areas to go into. I want to start, though, of course, with your book, It Can Happen Here, Authoritarian Peril in the Age of Bush. Most of the book, I would gather, was written prior to the November 2006 election, even though there's a little bit afterward. Since then, Bush's popularity has fallen to under 30%. The latest scandals involving Gonzales and the firing of attorneys, Walter Reed, continuing horrors in Iraq, all of that would seem to put the Bush administration on a further downward slope. You're talking about authoritarian peril here. Are we safer now or not?
He's still president. And in his definition of the presidency, he still has what they regard as plenary power, that is to say, the unitary executive, their theory of how presidential power is allocated in time of war, means that he still has far greater power than any president in history. That's their view. So I don't think we're necessarily safe. He is hobbled politically. And I wouldn't argue, and the book doesn't argue, that we are now in an authoritarian society. What I'm trying to explain in this book is that we have gone down that old cliche of the slippery slope further than people think during the last 6 years, and that this isn't an authoritarian regime, but it's a regime that wants to be authoritarian. And I try to explain what that means in this book.
It also is a regime, as future regimes would be if things don't change, that has the power to become authoritarian at the snap of your fingers.
Exactly. They have arrogated powers unto themselves and created legal definitions to override traditional constitutional balances of power in this society that really shouldn't be in the hands of any executive, whether it's a popular one or an unpopular one.
Joe Connison, you began writing this book, I would guess, when, a year or two ago?
I wrote it in a pretty short space of time last year.
During the writing, I guess you saw John Dean's book, Conservatives Without Conscience.
I'd seen it before, yeah. I mean, it came out around the time that I was probably in the middle or finishing this book. I hadn't read it while I was working on this, but I looked at it afterwards, and I read his previous book, which I thought was terrific, by the way. I'm a big admirer of John Dean.
Well, that particular book comes at it from a different place in order to try to convince true conservatives that these people were authoritarian. Your book, it's all about the rules and what they've done. It's very, very different, and in some respects, a lot scarier, I think.
I try to give a narrative, really, of what has happened. And that's one of the ways in which it's, although it's a nonfiction book, it's inspired by Sinclair Lewis's book, It Can't Happen Here, which was a satirical novel about a fictional president who comes to power with the help of somebody who reminds me very much of Karl Rove. This is a president who's a lot like George W. Bush in his character. And that book tells the story of what they do after they come to power. It seemed to me that one of the things that would help us would be to have a narrative that goes through the steps that have been taken, goes through the things that they've done, puts them together in a way that you can make sense of and that reminds you of things that you've forgotten that they've done, and also lays out some of the ideology behind this, starting with the neoconservative ideology, and then I also talk about the ideology of the religious right and how it plays into this, how they've allied themselves with the corporate right-wing elements, and finally how the roots of all of this that I see springing from the Nixon era. And there I think I have something in common with John and his writings.
We have something called conventional wisdom in this country, which pops up mostly in places like Newsweek and Time, filters through the New York Times and everywhere else, sometimes seems to start with Fox News, doesn't always. One piece of conventional wisdom, which Gore Vidal calls received wisdom, and I like that term better, concerned the fact that when Gerald Ford died, there was a huge emphasis on the fact that his pardoning of Nixon was a good thing and saved the country. And if it goes back to Nixon, then in fact, they're still fighting those battles, and the pardoning of Nixon meant that all of Nixon's lies and authoritarianism didn't fully come out.
Yes, well, there's the old saying, de nihil nisi mortuus bonum, or de mortuus nihil nisi bonum, which is to say you only say nice things about the dead, especially dead presidents. And there wasn't much to say about Gerald Ford except that he pardoned Nixon, so therefore you had to say something good about it. I would say that that's what I would call the conventional idiocy. What would have been much more useful would be to look back at the Ford administration and trace who comes from the Ford administration. What did they do then, and what are their intentions? And, of course, the first person you find is our Vice President, Dick Cheney, who, and I discussed this at some length in the book, worked for Gerald Ford. You know, Cheney was in the Nixon administration. Then he left in time to avoid the Watergate deluge that took down so many other people like him. But he felt very strongly that Nixon had been wronged, that Nixon was, in fact, the hero of Watergate, and that he was exercising executive power appropriately in a time of emergency, which is what Nixon himself said as his excuse. When Cheney returned to the White House with President Ford, one of the first things they did was to advise he and a young Justice Department attorney named Antonin Scalia and Don Rumsfeld, who was Cheney's mentor, advised President Ford that he should veto the Freedom of Information Act, which the new Congress, new Democratic Congress, in its reforming zeal, had amended to give real power to, so that we would finally have some transparency in government and undo the secrecy of the Nixon years. That was very bad advice, not only on the level of policy, but of politics, because what happened as a result was that Ford's veto was overwhelmingly overridden by the new Congress. He was humiliated, and his presidency actually never recovered. But if you flash forward, we now have Cheney in power again, and he has implemented broad-ranging secrecy in the government, up to and including even the names and titles and salaries and assignments of the people in his own office of the vice president. You cannot find out who works for him, except in very few cases that have been reported in the press. His attitude is, you don't need to know. I need to keep these things secret. And they've implemented broad-ranging secrecy in this government.
Cheney is a very scary fellow. The more I read about him and read about people who knew him at one time and know him now and all say the same thing, this is a different man. If he were to become president in the next 2 years, if something happened to Bush, everything in your book could be implemented instantly.
Oh, yeah. That's an almost unimaginably dangerous scenario. Luckily, Cheney's the one who's unhealthy, and Bush is out, is, you know, pumping iron every day. So we have to hope that, that Bush's health will hold up. As bad a president as he's been, I think Cheney would be considerably worse and more dangerous.
I want to talk about a couple of things that have happened since the book. One which you, I think you touch on in the book, but I want to go into it in more depth, is the Military Commissions Act. The media didn't mention this was basically Patriot Act II, which was turned back by Congress several years ago.
Right. Yes. And unfortunately, a couple of Republican senators who the press is dependent on as kind of the symbols of resistance to Bush's excesses actually played a very bad role in ushering through that act, which essentially provided a mechanism for the president to deprive people of habeas corpus rights at his will. Luckily, since the election of a new Congress and the shift in majorities, however precarious it is in the Senate, Senator Dodd, Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut, and Senator Pat Leahy, who is now the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, have said that they plan to amend the Military Commissions Act and restore habeas corpus in full to everybody, all prisoners. And if that happens, I think it's fair to say the president will veto it. And that'll be a real test for everybody in the Senate as to whether you're able to get a veto override on that. But at the very least, we will begin to have a public education process where instead of doing what happened in the first Patriot Act, where the bill was rushed up to the Hill.
Nobody read it.
Nobody read it. The Attorney General told the members of Congress, I need you to pass this in 3 days, which is essentially the, you know, the kind of deadline that a banana republic legislature has for passing the executive's will. They passed it in a few weeks. At least I think now we're going to have a real discussion of what this legislation would mean, why it needs to be changed to restore this traditional right that predates the founding of the American Republic by hundreds of years, and why it should matter to everybody, even though, you know, you will hear people say, well, I'm not a terrorist. We have to sort of go back to the fundamental education in what human rights and civil rights mean, which is that if they don't exist for everybody, they don't exist for anybody.
There's another proviso in there which was snuck in at the last minute, which did not get any press until very recently, which is kind of a martial law proviso, which seems to allow the government to bring the army into the United States for the first time.
Right. This is a provision that would basically abolish the Posse Comitatus Act, which was always meant to prevent, again, it was a means of preventing the executive from abusing domestic power by essentially turning the army into a police force against the people. And, of course, the concern about that dates back to the time when the country was occupied by the army of King George, billeted in people's houses involuntarily, oppressing them, killing them, robbing them. So the Posse Comitatus Act was meant to prevent anything like that from ever happening again. Now, this is yet another example, among many examples that I discuss in the book, of the gradual aggrandizement of power to the executive. And the fact that many of these powers have not been exercised in any massively oppressive way yet doesn't mean you shouldn't worry about them. It's better to worry about them before that happens, rather than to wait until it's too late to do anything about it.
Well, when you look at authoritarian regimes, the powers come before they're implemented.
Correct. This is the fundamental reason for this book, is for people to understand what has been put in place, what's already been taken away, so that we can take the first steps towards getting those liberties back.
Joe Connison, how do the Gonzales firings play into the authoritarianism?
One of the greatest things, in my view, about our law enforcement system is that the United States attorneys, who are appointed by the president to enforce federal law in every judicial district across the country, are relatively independent once they're appointed. They are appointed in consultation with the senators in their home states of either party. This is a tradition that has been established in the Senate for a long time because they have to be confirmed by the Senate. And once they're in office, they're supposed to act in the most nonpartisan way possible. The reason for that is that it's their responsibility to police the politicians. And in a free society, you can't really do that if the law enforcement system is an instrument of political control. Now, what Gonzales seems to have done, with the connivance of the White House, as far as anybody can tell, is to start to use political criteria not only to select the U.S. attorneys, but to fire them if they are not performing according to the political aspirations of the White House and some people in the Congress. In other words, they're being used as an instrument of Republican control. They've fired, I believe, at least 8 of them, either because, and by the way, despite sterling performance evaluations of these people, they're among the best, not the worst, but they fired them because either they were too zealously prosecuting Republicans, prosecuting Democrats with too little zeal and not doing it in time for an election, or because they wanted to make room for somebody who would do those things with greater efficiency and zeal than the current occupant of that position. They snuck a provision into the Patriot Act with the help of Arlen Specter, senator from Pennsylvania, although he claims he didn't know about it, that allowed them to bypass the usual protections that were meant to stop this kind of thing. So this is, again, the creation of sort of banana republic standards, transforming the United States attorneys and the control of them into an instrument of political control by the Republican Party, by the White House and the Attorney General. They did grave, grave damage to what is one of the best institutions of American government. Lawyers on both sides of the political divide are outraged about this.
They coupled that with the packing of judges. I mean, when we saw that the recent ruling upholding the lack of habeas corpus,
right.
I mean, that was astonishing.
It was an appeals court, yeah.
I mean, that'll go to the Supreme Court.
It will.
And more than likely, it won't stand up, just based on what we've seen so far.
Well, we hope it won't stand up in this Supreme Court. One of the things that I raise as a concern in this book, however, is that there are now 4 votes on this Supreme Court for the Bush-Cheney point of view about the powers of the executive, as opposed to the judiciary and the legislature. Justice Thomas, Justice Scalia, although he's less enthusiastic about the other 3, but still he has supported this, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. One more vote. One more justice confirmed, chosen by Bush and Cheney and confirmed to the Supreme Court, would give them 5, which would mean that this, in my view, un-American, unconstitutional theory could be ratified by the Supreme Court and given the color of law in the Constitution. And that is something that would stand for many, many years.
You're listening to an interview with Joe Connison, whose latest book is It Can Happen Here. I'd like to switch gears a little and talk about the role of the media, not just in authoritarianism, but generally in our country. The mainstream media in its infinite wisdom or non-wisdom, decided that, oh, God, you know, we made a mistake about Iraq, but they're still not copping to the election or the non-election of Bush and the way Bush was treated with kid gloves for 5 years.
They never will. I mean, look, you know, I wrote a whole book about the whole book wasn't about that, but I wrote a book, a substantial portion, which was about how the press had treated Bill Clinton and how the mainstream press had basically followed the lead of right-wing media outlets and smear campaigns in trying to take down the Clinton administration. They've never owned up to any of that either. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the main television networks have never, I think, gone through the necessary self-examination. To me, it's less important that they admit publicly that they made a mistake than that they go through some period of introspection about what they did so they might improve their performance because they're so powerful. These are institutions that aren't going away. They will retain a great deal of power in spite of the what some people see as their declining relevance in the Internet era. They still wield the greatest power, and in fact, the blogosphere kind of revolves around them in many ways and the material that they put out every day. So it's a big problem that there is not a self-critical function. Fortunately, there's a lot of criticism of them that is available on the radio, on the Internet, and I think that has begun to create what Albert Camus once wished for more than 50 years ago when he said that what Paris needed was a control newspaper that came out every day to correct the errors of all of the Parisian press. We are beginning to have something like that that is available to large numbers of people in a wide variety of forms, and I think that's a very good thing.
Yeah, but the people who read those are not necessarily the people who are going to take action or actually deal with the highest levels of government.
Well, they're people who have the capacity still in our system to become active, though, politically, and I think that's what we have to hope will happen, and it shows some signs that it is happening. Look, I think it's very important for people to support independent media of all kinds. Otherwise, we really are at the mercy of people whose arrogance far exceeds their competence.
About a year ago, Keith Olbermann became a well-known commentator on television, and his ratings began to go up. We've seen no new Olbermanns.
The right wing has spent 30 years erecting a barrier to progressive thought in the mass media and the mainstream media by making all of these media executives very fearful of being labeled liberal. There's a part of their inner conscience that worries that maybe they are liberal. The thing they're most worried about is being labeled, and that creates a psychological and bureaucratic barrier that's very great, and it is hard to break through. The only way to do that is for progressives and liberals to make as much noise on the other side as the conservatives have made to create that barrier, to make the media as afraid of being labeled conservative as they are afraid of being labeled liberal. Then you might begin to see a little bit of parity. What Keith's experience proves is that there is a market, which is the ultimate measure of everything, and there's clearly a market for a different perspective than the usual conservative drivel that you find on the airwaves.
Has Fox News' influence declined, you think, in the past 6-8 months?
Well, I think Fox News made the mistake of tying their fortunes completely to the regime. And so the declining popularity of the regime has caused people to turn away from them. Not only that, but they don't seem to be particularly supple in their response to all this. They are still parroting the regime line. They had people on there calling instantly for the pardon of Louis Libby as soon as he was convicted, as if everybody in the country agreed with them. And, you know, I think that showed that, you know, basically Roger Ailes had one move to the basket, and when that stopped working, he hadn't yet figured out something else to do with his news channel.
Joe Connison, getting back to It Can Happen Here, there's several themes in the book. I jotted down a few of them involving the ways in which authoritarianism works, and of course, as John Dean pointed out, and as many have pointed out, this is nothing new. It's the same thing that's gone on in several authoritarian countries.
Sure. It is what it is, as they say. I mean, authoritarianism, there's a definition of it. And one of the clearest definitions of it is a system that centralizes power in very few hands and suppresses or demonizes dissent and seeks to overturn whatever constitutional authority there was before it existed. This is what they do, and this is what we see the beginnings of under this regime, and it's as deplorable as it was everywhere else that it's ever happened.
Recently, I read a book called Imperial Life in the Emerald City, mm-hmm. which was it's written by the former Washington Post correspondent in the Green Zone.
Rajiv Chandrasekharan, who's a brilliant reporter.
What got me was that the Republicans in the book kept talking about the evil Baathists, and they looked to be the same to me.
You know, one of the things that Rajiv's book explores is that ideology was much more the measure for the Bush administration in choosing who would try to implement its policies in Iraq than experience or competence. Those things were set aside, and ideology, which is to say support of the president, support of the neoconservative ideology, trumped everything in selecting people to take these jobs in Iraq. The result has been, you know, a predictable disaster. And I go into some of the examples of that as well in my book, just because it's important for people to have an understanding, to see where these problems come from. If you are using government as an instrument not to achieve public policy ends so much as to consolidate your own power, then you will make decisions along those lines because you will be using government resources to bolster your friends and to create centers of power, centers of authority on an ideological basis rather than trying to achieve the policy goals that are your expressed purpose. And that's been a huge mistake. We've spent billions of dollars, literally, giving away the store to people who we think are our ideological friends and to Republican patronage recipients like the Lincoln Group, which is one of the organizations that I examine, which is a group of, you know, young Republicans who got, you know, were being paid $80,000 a day to write press releases that they tried to put into the Iraqi press. I mean, it was just a huge scam.
Rajiv goes into that in great depth. I mean, these guys knew nothing.
The truth is, somebody ought to be prosecuted for this. I don't know whether they ever will. But, you know, when billions of dollars just go missing this way or are squandered or wasted or handed out to people on a partisan basis like this, you would expect some oversight and some accountability. And I hope that the Government Operations Committee in the House, which is now chaired by Henry Waxman, who is one of the best members of the House, he happens to be from California, will start to peel away some of this corruption.
John Yoo. You talk about him. I'd never heard of him. He's teaching law in Berkeley now?
Oh, he's at Bolt Hall, yeah, right down the street here.
That's a scary thought. This guy's a clown. He shouldn't be teaching law anywhere.
Well, you know, he's had a lot of publicity as a brilliant legal theorist. I'm not a legal theorist. I'm not even a lawyer. There are a lot of lawyers who will tell you that his theories about the unitary executive and the alleged powers of the president in wartime have no basis in constitutional authority at all, and they are simply a rather thin justification for policies that simply are meant to ratify the power of the party that John Yoo happens to belong to, which is the Republican Party. You know, there were people like him, and I want to hasten to say he's not a Nazi. I'm not saying they're Nazis, but every authoritarian regime from the Nazis onward has had somebody like John Yoo who pops up as a legal scholar who can concoct a theory that somehow legally justifies whatever it is that they want to do. In Germany, there was a man named Carl Schmitt, who was an eminent legal scholar. He happens to have been a kind of a mentor to Leo Strauss, who was the godfather of the neoconservatives, even though Schmitt didn't think too much of Jews and Strauss happened to be Jewish. But in every authoritarian regime, there is someone like this who is the designated brilliant legal scholar who comes forward with a theory that justifies their plan.
His mentor was Silberman, who
yes.
was one of the people responsible for bringing Ken Starr in to prosecute Clinton.
That's right. Judge Lawrence Silberman, a dogged partisan in the judiciary, somebody whose persistently inappropriate conduct on the bench actually, thankfully, prevented him from ever being put on the Supreme Court, who has nevertheless carried out, you know, a 30 years war within the judiciary to put forward the same ideology that Cheney and others adhere to that dates back to the Nixon era, and Judge Silberman himself also dates back to the Nixon era. John Yoo was a clerk for Silberman, and Silberman was his mentor. And Silberman is also interesting because he was, this is very typical of the style of government that we're talking about. Judge Silberman was put in charge of the FISA court by Justice Rehnquist before he died.
And FISA is?
A Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is the place that they were supposed to go for warrants when they want to wiretap, when they want to institute certain kinds of wiretaps. And the reason that they put Judge Silberman in charge of that court was that he doesn't believe in FISA at all. Like so many officials in this government, he was appointed to administer a law that he thinks should not be enforced, which always leads to a very curious sort of contradiction.
Joe Connison, in your book, It Can Happen Here, you discuss partisanship, corruption, the power of an authoritarian regime in all other areas. I want to cover a few recent events and relate this back. One happened before this, which was Katrina. How does Katrina tie in? And maybe it just ties into the bankruptcy of conservative thought. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Hurricane Katrina disaster, you know, exposed a lot of things about the Republican administration and about the Bush administration. But the most important thing that it revealed was how little thought or concern is given by this kind of government to the actual functions of government and to serving people's needs. That is not what the apparatus of government is for an authoritarian regime or in a regime that aspires to be authoritarian. Everything in government and every dollar that government spends, from their point of view, is meant to somehow shore up their own power. And so what you had was these people came in. A crony of the president was put in charge of the Federal Emergency Management Administration. He had no qualifications for it. He stepped down from FEMA, but he had another crony come in and run FEMA, the famous Brownie, or the infamous Brownie. And so when disaster struck, they had dismantled what had been actually a very well-functioning government agency under the previous administration, and the people of New Orleans were left really unprotected. You could have a non-authoritarian point of view that would still be incompetent. You could have people do this badly without seeking to merely aggrandize their power. But to me, this was just an example of one of the costs of this kind of government, where they don't see government as an important service to people. They see government as something that they use to serve themselves.
And then there's the Walter Reed Hospital scandal.
Well, you know, that exposed their pretensions in a different way. This is a group, and I examine this in some detail in the first chapter of the book, that regards war and the idea of permanent war as a very important component of establishing dominating power. War is the excuse in the theory of the unitary executive for the president's plenary authority over everyone and everything else. And the reason that it is supposed to work, of course, is that it excites patriotism. It creates a patriotic state of mind in which people are otherwise unable to think for themselves about anything. Your patriotism overwhelms your ability to actually consider the reality that's in front of you. In It Can't Happen Here, Sinclair Lewis's book, there's a very important episode where they decide to wage a preemptive war on Mexico and fabricate a casus belli where the Mexicans supposedly create some outrage along the border, which they then want to publicize through propaganda and invade Mexico as a distraction for other problems that they're having. All of this depends on making people think that there's a patriotic cause that has to be defended. And as part of that, of course, you will always express great concern for the troops, because if you oppose these maneuvers, you are against the troops. If you do anything to debate or question what the regime is doing, you have betrayed the troops. Well, of course, Walter Reed, the situation at Walter Reed and other veterans' hospitals and services shows somebody else betrayed the troops. It's not the war critics who have betrayed the troops. It is the government that has betrayed the troops by failing to provide the kind of care that these wounded soldiers need when they come home from Iraq, failing to anticipate or improve these services over the last 4 years, when they must have realized after the first year at least that we were going to have many more wounded, simply because actually the VA and the Army Medical Services generally do a good job of saving people's lives once they're wounded and in the battlefield, but they come home and they need services, especially many of them have head traumas. They need benefits, usually for a lifetime. They come home with post-traumatic stress disorder. Almost all of them have that when they get home. And the Army and the VA were absolutely unprepared and understaffed and underfunded to deal with all of this. Now, what's even worse about this is that these problems were not just exposed recently in the Washington Post.
Salon hit it up 2 years ago.
Salon's right? Mark Benjamin did a brilliant investigation of this 2 years ago, which the administration just plainly ignored. They did not care.
But the mainstream media ignored it, too.
Yes, they did. Well, I mean, you know, I assume that Dana Priest and her colleagues at the Washington Post did their own research. They happen to be very good reporters. They've done a lot of good work there. She said she hadn't read Mark's article, and I would take her word for that. But, yes, you're right. I mean, this is something that the rest of the media ought to have gone on to 2 years ago, and I've yet to hear them explain why they didn't.
Joe Connison, the title of the book, It Can Happen Here, is, of course, based on Sinclair Lewis's 1935 novel, which pretty much nobody reads anymore. How did you... But they should. Well, apparently it's not very well written.
It's not as good as his other novels, and he was painfully aware of that. But I'll tell you, it sold like hotcakes in 1935. It sold 300,000 copies, which today would be like selling a million copies.
Did you stumble onto the title? Somebody said to you, "It can happen here," and suddenly you went back and...
I didn't stumble on it. I was pushed towards it by my editor at Thomas Dunn Books. Tom Dunn was attempting to motivate me to write another book and said, "You know, you really ought to look at this Sinclair Lewis book." And I did. And I will say, I agree, it's not one of his best written books. It has a sort of a fast-paced kind of pot boiler feel to it, and he wrote it in 3 months. And he said it was a bad book himself, and privately. But you can read it. It has its moments, and the message of it was certainly incredibly effective in 1935 and 36. It was produced as a play in 20 cities and almost became a film. And I'll tell you, the Nazis and the fascists in Italy were so scared of this book that when MGM had a script written, they threatened the Hays office that if this movie were to be made, no more Hollywood films would be exhibited in Italy or Germany.
You bring up Hollywood, and I am thinking about the relationship of how the Hollywood moguls, the Jewish Hollywood moguls, caved into the Hays Commission in 1934 because they were afraid they were going to be labeled as Jews. They saw what was going on in Europe. And I wonder if it makes sense to compare that to the way the mainstream media caves into the right wing in America today.
It's missing the ethnic component, although not entirely. You know, when the right gets agitated enough about what's going on in the media, they will start to talk about the cosmopolitan, homosexual, I mean, all these synonyms for a liberal. Liberal is almost a synonym for Jews in the far right in America. It is reminiscent of that in sort of the surrender to a bullying anti-intellectual force. And I think, yeah, I've said this so many times, I think it's just disgraceful.
Joe Connison, what's going on with Air America?
Well, in the last chapter of the Perils of Air America, a sudden rescue appeared with the arrival of the Green family. Mark Green, who has been a politician and writer, progressive leader in New York for many years, showed up, his brother at his side, and his brother happens to be a real estate billionaire who has always supported Mark's work in different ways. And they bought Air America, and they have started to try to figure out how to revamp it into a more successful form. Of course, I wish them luck. I mean, I'm back on the air there with a host named Sam Cedar on Friday mornings, and I guess people can get it streaming if it's not on the air. But, of course, I miss Franken. Everybody does. And it'll be interesting to see how the new Air America is configured without him.
A few other questions, getting back to authoritarian. We have an election coming up, hopefully, in 2008. You know, part of me goes, I know that I'm insane, but a part of me goes, I can't imagine these people are going to give up power.
Well, that's, you know, people say that, and it's an interesting speculation. It's kind of titillating. I actually think that they don't quite have the guts to try to do that, and I also feel that there is a very substantial portion of the military that would not countenance that. You'd see real resistance to that, and I think a good portion of it would come from the uniformed military, which includes many officers of the, what you call in other authoritarian countries, the constitutionalist officers, the ones who believe that they took an oath to the Constitution and mean to uphold it.
What about a Praetorian Guard of people from Blackwater and Wackenhut?
Well, you mean a rumble between the mercenaries and the gosh. Well, now we're writing our own movie, but I don't think they'd be a match for the Marines. Let's just put it that way.
I don't think so either. But more seriously, aside from these constitutional issues, the military is not much of a fan of the neocons of the Bush administration these days. Correct?
Well, the leaders of the uniformed military are much more sensible than their civilian overseers in the Pentagon and the White House. Look upon the works of the neoconservatives with great trepidation and think that they're crazy. It's very clear that the idea that we would start another war in Iran is one that is not accepted. The uniformed leadership understands that our 150,000 or so troops in Iraq are in grave jeopardy if we suddenly start military hostilities with Iran, which is next door and has about 800,000 men under arms, a real army, real armored forces, a real air force, and the ability to cut off our supply chain to our people in Iraq from the south, which is the only way they can get anything. So, you know, when trained military strategists look at this situation, the first thought that comes to their mind is not, we need to start a war with the people next door while we're in the midst of this civil war in Iraq. And if we are saved from the consequences of what I think would be a disastrous decision to get into a military conflict with Iran, it will be, I believe, not because of civilian protest or dissent in the Congress so much as the resistance of the uniformed military.
Where do you think Gates fits in on this? I mean, he's not a neocon.
No, he's a bit of a conundrum to me. I mean, I think there are signs that somebody, and I don't know if it's Bob Gates or not, is pushing the administration in a slightly different and more realistic direction than what they seem to be intent on. For instance, you know, they've reversed their determination never to speak to Iran and Syria. Suddenly, having said when the Iraq Study Group report came out that they would never do that, in spite of the advice from James Baker and Lee Hamilton that they should, and the other members of the commission, they have recently said, well, you know, we are going to see them at this summit, this regional summit. I thought that was a good sign that somebody has talked some sense to them. But I worry, of course, that this is like their support for the inspection regime in Iraq that preceded the war. This is more in the nature of, well, we tried that. And it didn't work, so now we have to go to Plan B, which was really Plan A.
Right, but in this case, I mean, the stupidity, we're stretched so thin, we can barely hang on to Afghanistan.
Yeah, I don't know if we can hang on to Afghanistan. People are predicting a spring offensive by the Taliban, and I'm not sure that the NATO forces are prepared for that at all. You know, this is one of the grave costs of the Iraq War and the general unilateralist policy of the administration, is that the ability to rally the world to defeat the Taliban, which is exactly where people were on the day after 9/11, they've really pissed that away. And unfortunately for the Afghan people and for us, there isn't a lot left to deal with that situation, any more than there is to extricate us in an honorable way from Iraq at this point.
There are several people running for president, a little bit early now. And a few of them, we know how they would respond to this. They would dismantle it. And I'm thinking particularly of Edwards, Obama. I'm not sure about Hillary Clinton.
Well, it's interesting you would say that. I happen to think that Mrs. Clinton, who got very good constitutional law training at Yale Law School, understands what her responsibilities would be very well. I hope that she would realize that these incursions on constitutional authority should be repaired. And I believe she would. But I will tell you that the feeling in the country is I'll get a call from a conservative when I'm on the air, and they'll say, well, I don't really mind the president wiretapping our phones because I'm not a terrorist and, you know, I'm just ordering pizza or whatever I'm doing, and they're after the terrorists. I'm not worried about the Patriot Act. And I always ask those people a question, which is, how would you feel if it were President Hillary Clinton doing that? and there's always silence. So people, fairly or not, do suspect her of seeking aggrandized power. I think that's very much a myth. But to me, at least at the moment, it's kind of a useful myth because I think it helps to make even the most rigid conservatives realize, or rigid supporters of this president realize, that when there's another president, you might not want that other president to have these aggrandized powers. And that's really at the foundation of what the people who wrote the Constitution saw as the reason for a balance of powers and a reason for checks on the executive. Is you don't know who the president's going to be or whether you're going to like what they intend to do.
And that's what scares me most about Giuliani, because we saw what he did in New York. He was a dictator.
Giuliani is a person who I think ought to give deep pause to anyone who cares about these issues, and I would say that about people on the right as well as the left. I happen to think that the progressives are not the only people who are concerned about this. There are plenty of what you could call honest conservatives who worry about aggrandized executive power just as much as we do. And when they look at Giuliani rising possibly to the head of their party, I think if they know anything about what he did in New York, they would have to be concerned at the very least.
And what about McCain? Where does he stand?
Well, you know, on the one hand, I think McCain has something of an authoritarian personality, and he certainly pushed forward a lot of the war policies and others. On the other hand, he did speak out against the torture policy. And then on the other hand, he helped to usher through the Military Commissions Act. So you can never tell where you are with McCain on any of this. I don't consider him a reliable defender of constitutional authority, no.
What can we do, Joe Connison, at our end, other than be alert?
Well, it's very important to, I think, for people to be active participants in the country's political life in every way that they can. That's the only way you preserve this democracy, is by participating in it and by demanding that the people who represent you protect your rights. It's the same answer that I've given before. It is the only answer. That's the only thing that you can do. And that means activity both in and out of the electoral sphere. It's not just electoral politics. It's organizing around these issues. Once you get a reasonably good person elected, they still need you to push them and to get behind them and force them to do what it is that, even though they know they should do it. When FDR was elected president, I believe he had the best intentions from the beginning. He was visited by a group of liberals in the Oval Office, and they started laying out the list of the things that he should do as president. And he said to them, make me do it. Go out there, create the conditions, the political conditions under which this will all be an imperative for the country. And I think that's what people have to do now.
You've been listening to an interview with Joe Connison, whose latest book is It Can Happen Here, Authoritarian Peril in the Age of Bush. Joe Connison can also be heard Fridays at what time?
I guess it's sometime around 9 Eastern on the Sam Cedar Show on Air America. They can look on my blog, actually, on joeconnison.com, and we'll have all that information. And also, you know, my TV appearances and book signings and things like that.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.